Welcome to this week's episode of The Shill Report, episode 13, where journalism is reviewed and the stories of the week are expanded and explained. I'm your host, Ryan Ripley. Joining me on this quest to shed the light of liberty on the week's news is publisher of We Are Libertarians, Mr. Chris Spengel.
Sup?
And managing editor of We Are Libertarians news site, Joe Ruiz.
What's up?
Nice little what's up there, Chris.
Holla.
Holla. All right, guys, let's jump right into it this week. We hinted during the Ron Paul episode that We Are Libertarians news site and The Shill Report made some news, but we really didn't get into it. I thought we'd dovetail back and try to at least give the viewers and listeners, if you're viewing on Google Hangout, why. And then for the listeners, thank you. A little look into how, you know, the three of us and specifically, you know, Joe and Chris went about making the national news. And it all starts with the talent. So, Joe, if you could give some insights into how exactly we landed Ron Paul in the first place. Let's start there. I think
Wait a minute. You're starting with Joe? I thought you said you were starting with the talent. Boom.
Hey, look. Someone's got to do the legwork to book the guys. And then, Chris, you work your magic, right? So, Joe, can you give us a little insight? Booking Ron Paul, the process, how you went about it, just so that, you know, let's be a little transparent about how this happened, because it really was, it was a neat event for We Are Libertarians and a great event for The Shill Report. And I think it would be great if we could just give a little insight and transparency about how this came about.
I don't really remember. It all kind of happened so fast with booking Ron Paul. I'm not sure. But I think it all kind of falls back to the power of just asking. And I don't know that I could necessarily take credit if it's the way that I word things, or I would love for that to be the case. Maybe I'm just a smooth talker, and, you know, and I'm successful at talking to people and making them feel like we're something important enough to be a part of. But, you know, for whatever reason, I just began to have conversations with Ron Paul's talent agent, and within a matter of a couple of weeks, we were able to make it happen. And the next thing you know, Ron Paul's on our show, and it was a wild ride from there, and that wild ride's kind of continuing at this point.
How did you know where to look for Ron Paul's booking agent?
Google. Like, honestly, I mean, I have literally just been Googling, you know, how I can get a hold of these people and doing a little bit of research, putting a little bit of independent time in, you know, and along the lines, I've been able to find some names.
Why don't you mention who else we've got coming up on the show here, who we've got booked out?
Well, obviously we had Jeffrey Tucker last week, which was huge for us because he was so insightful and he was so excellent to have on the show. We are going to have Noam Chomsky next week, who, you know, he's an MIT professor and he's someone who has been very engaged in the political conversation throughout his life and career.
He's written books on the media and propaganda. Very interesting. A lot of libertarians don't agree with him on a lot of stuff, but right. Interesting point of view. So,
yeah, it should be one of those shows next week where it's going to engage you. It's going to make you think, and he's going to have arguments that are very stimulating, and you might be angry, you might shake your computers, you might throw your mouse across the room, or you might say, wow, I've never really thought of it that way. But either way, it's going to make you think, and that's what's going to be great about it. And then coming up in October, we're going to have Julie Borowski from FreedomWorks. You might know her as the Token Libertarian Girl on YouTube. And she has a series of videos that are very entertaining, very funny, very fantastic.
She manages to take really complex topics, and she handles them in a pretty fair way, in a balanced way, but she also keeps you entertained. So I think that's going to be a really fun discussion with her, just because she's managed to take a lot of the messaging that libertarians have suffered through, and she's really put, you know, a nice look to it. I mean, and that's not a comment on, don't take that comment the wrong
Joe,
way.
Joe, did you just hear what Ryan just said?
I think I did hear it.
Wow. That was really inappropriate. I hope your wife doesn't hear that. No, what you were saying, she does libertarian philosophy in a unique way.
Yes.
One of my favorite videos of hers that she has is why there aren't a lot of females in the libertarian movement. And that's interesting to hear from a female's perspective, and I've always thought that it's something that we can speculate at as men, but to hear it from a woman's perspective and the way she breaks it down is very simple. It's very easy to grasp. And I hope that if enough women were to see that, then there would be more women kind of filtering over. So it'll be good to put a spotlight on that, having her on our show.
So who else do we have, Joe?
October 26th, we are going to get the former governor of New Mexico and former Libertarian Party presidential candidate Gary Johnson, which is, I mean, a huge honor for all of us because, you know, I think most of us are a fan of Governor Johnson and have been a fan of his career and his presidential run last year.
Some of us voted for Gary Johnson. Others might have voted for Barack Obama.
I voted for Gary Johnson.
Oh, I thought you were a Democrat. I'm
Gary
sorry.
Gary Johnson. Fail.
That was for Greg Lenz, who repeatedly makes fun of you for being a Democrat.
Oh. Yeah, nice try there.
You know, and those are the guests, I think. We've talked to a few people lately, but I think those are the ones that we have concrete. Those are the ones that are locked down. We've got a few that are pending that are big names, and so I would expect some big things to come for the show report in terms of the guests that we're booking. I'm very excited about it, and there will be more to come in the following weeks.
Yeah, guys, for all the listeners out there, Joe's really putting in a ton of effort here. He's reached out to some pretty amazing people and is actually getting some really great responses. So should be an exciting end of the year. You know, October looking pretty full with some great guests, as we mentioned. November and December are starting to shape up to be some really interesting interesting guests, and so it should be some interesting shows. So great work to Joe. You know, nice work there.
Thank
now,
you.
Timing on the Ron Paul interview. So Joe booked the talent. He got us our time with Dr. Ron Paul. The timing could not have been better. You know, the day before Dr. Paul came on the show report, he was on Alex Wagner's show on MSNBC, and they had kind of a tussle. You know, Alex tried to pin him down on or corner him on a few things related to a talk he was giving with a controversial group. It got a little heated, and during our interview, Dr. Paul commented on that altercation, and that is really what spurred the national news. But there was something there before we were able to get that comment that I wanted Chris to talk about a little bit. We typically don't, you know, most podcasts won't talk about their oopsies, but I think it's important that we kind of dive into this one. Chris, can you talk a little bit about how the Dr. Paul interview that made national news was almost the interview that didn't happen?
Going back to my radio days, I've had a full-fledged panic. Anybody who's been in broadcasting, there always comes that moment where you have done something to screw it up, and you have 10 seconds to fix it, and you've got to figure it out. And that happened to me. I left the recorder at work on the Friday that we were supposed to interview Ron Paul. We use a Zoom H2N to record everything because it's a great recorder. It sounds great. You know, you're not going to have your computer crash if you're recording, you know, like you are with Audition or with Audacity. Sometimes your computer will crash in the middle of a show, especially hour-long shows. The file just gets so big that it craps out. So I sit down about a half an hour before and go to get everything set up, and all of a sudden I realize that I don't have the recorder. I start rifling around in my bag about 30 minutes before Ron Paul's scheduled to call in. I've already got everything all set up. I realize the recorder's not here. So I do the hyperventilating, rifle through every bag, even though it's a big thing. Could it be in my pockets of my pants? I look at my car, maybe if it fell out, and I spend 10 minutes just panicking looking for this thing. And then I pull myself together and I just say, okay, it's not here. You've left it at work. You took it in. There's nothing you can do about it. You're a half an hour away from the office. So what are you going to do? I sit there and I go, all right, well, maybe I can record on my iPhone. So I try and figure out how to hook the board up. I'm just scrambling like mad. I eventually restart my computer. I get Audition working and we record it. And this all happens 2 minutes before the interview. Meanwhile, all I hear from these jokers is Captain Impatient Pants over there and Mr. Nudgy. They're like, oh, well, you got to get on. We got to do this, Sprangle. We got to. And I just scream in the chat room, shut the F up. Leave me alone.
I'm freaking out here. And little do you know, Spangle, that Ryan and I were on Facebook Messenger sending each other private messages. How could he mess this up during Ron Paul Day?
Right. So.
Yeah, Joe and I were completely useless. Chris is scrambling. And in the meantime, we're just silently praying. Oh, please don't let him be early. Don't let him be early.
Yeah. Well, because we're already nervous enough because this is our first major interview on the show. We want everything to go well. It's Ron Paul, someone we have a lot of respect for. Right. And all of a sudden, our world, which we usually have, you know, fairly polished, is falling apart.
Yeah. I mean, there is hundreds of podcasts done over the course of this year. And I personally am recording and doing podcasts probably 4 to 6 hours a week. I'm recording stuff. Never have any problems at all. And then the one time that it actually matters, you know what, I had Skype up, so if he called, I was going to be able to pick it up, but I wasn't going to have any way to record it. So thank God the following happened, and we got a chance to breathe.
We were the benefactors of a time zone confusion that led Dr. Paul to believing that it was 4 o'clock Central and not 4 o'clock Eastern. So that actually bought us the hour we needed to figure out how exactly we were going to record this thing. So it was definitely a series of unfortunate events followed up by a very happy accident that led to us actually being able to do the interview with Dr. Paul.
I think we have to give credit where credit is due to Greg Lenz from We Are Libertarians, because here we are. We finally got everything figured out. We're wondering, all right, any minute now. It's a few minutes after the time that we were supposed to start the interview. Did we miss Ron Paul's call? Why hasn't he called in yet? Maybe he's on a press tour and he's going from one interview to another, and he just went over on the last one. There were a lot of things that we were speculating at that point. But before we knew of the time zone confusion, we were sitting around wondering, why isn't he calling? Now that we've got all this stuff figured out, where's he at? And so Greg Lenz, being some sort of detective on my computer,
Greg,
he was up
ninja
here visiting me in South Bend, and he gets on my computer, and I don't know what website he went to or how he found it, but he had somehow, in a matter of minutes, managed to find all of Ron Paul's booking agent's personal information and gave him a phone call and was like, hey, this is Greg Lenz from We Are Libertarians. The guys were just a little bit curious about, you know, Ron Paul's interview a few minutes after. Maybe he got tied up, and we just wanted to, you know, call in as a courtesy and see where things were at. They're ready to go when you are. And he's like, oh, well, I think Ron Paul might have been a little bit confused about the time zone. Let me go ahead and give his people a call, and we'll figure it out. So a few minutes later, he sends an email, and he says, okay, I think we've got it all together. Can we do it in an hour? So, of course, we agreed to it. And then the interview happened. But kudos to Greg for being able to dig all of that up at a moment's notice.
I think he found it on LinkedIn or Facebook. I mean, there's a wealth of booking information on those two services.
Is that what he did? Okay.
I think so, yeah.
All I saw was the back of the monitor, and he was just over there going to town.
So as we're going through the interview, you know, one of the questions that we had posed was about how the media is interacting with Ron Paul, which is fairly hostile. There's a strain running through the media, and especially in the liberal press. Like, there was an article in Alternet and on Salon. Salon has figured out that trolling libertarians is good for traffic. You know, 11 things that libertarians say that make them hypocrites. It is all a response to the quote-unquote libertarian-Republican strain running through Congress right now and trying to discredit them, which I find interesting because there's philosophically there is a lot that Ron Paul and MSNBC would agree on, and yet they look at him as some sort of figure to demonize, and it really all boils down to politics. And Ron Paul was on the Alex Wagner interview, and she attacked him about the newsletters that are like 40 years old and mean nothing now, but it continually comes up. You know, he said, basically, I didn't like what happened on the interview. I didn't like it, and it's all because of Rand. And, you know, if you're listening to this now, you hopefully listened to the Ron Paul interview. And my little spider sense kind of went up, and I thought, okay, that was a good quote. What if we put it into a story on the website, and then we tweeted out to all of those that wrote about the Alex Wagner brouhaha for the major news outlets, or major aggregators. I quickly write it up, edit the audio, cut out the relevant portion of the audio, and then I tweet it to all of the authors of those who wrote the story about Alex Wagner and Ron Paul on Mediaite, Huffington Post, The Blaze, The Daily Caller. Any one of those sites that covered it, I found their Twitter account and I tweeted it to them. And you really only kind of have to hit one, because if you really read things on the internet, you realize that it's basically just a bunch of news sites linking back and forth to each other. And it just so happened that Mediaite, their editor, happened to see the tweet, was in front of Twitter, picked it up, sent it to one of their reporters, wrote a story about it on Friday night. Then on Saturday, the Huffington Post and the Blaze pick it up, and the Huffington Post drives so much traffic to our website that it continually crashes. So we spent all weekend, I spent most of that weekend trying to figure out how to get the website to work properly, because the theme that we use wasn't properly optimized for that level of throttling. So luckily, we now have a website that we know that can handle that traffic because of this blessing in disguise. But it turned out this little victory turned into a big victory and added about 100 more subscribers to the RSS feed, to the RSS reader, and another 100 to the We Are Libertarians podcast, and then another 50 or so to the show report. So it was really, you get one hit like that and it just increases your traffic. And it's powerful because it moves people beyond our personal circles, the people that had been listening to the podcast, into maybe other circles. So that's how we managed to make Mediaite. We just took this interview, found one part of it that we knew would catch on. Unfortunately, the things that are philosophical in the interview don't catch on. It's the little bickering back and forth that catches on and gets the traffic, but you use that so people can hear the red meat stuff.
And then even during, in the background, while Chris is tweeting out to these authors, I pulled up, there's a top 25 libertarian Twitter accounts online, and so I pulled that up. And then while Chris is hitting the media people, I'm hitting the top 25 libertarian Twitter accounts, you know, shooting out the link saying, hey, we got this exclusive soundbite. And so that got, you know, a number of those people stirring as well. And so between, you know, Chris really knocking out, first of all, his spider sense was spot on, pulled out that excellent soundbite. You know, I think within about, what was it, 30 seconds, he had a multiple paragraph news story up on the site and had the tweet out. And I mean, he was really rolling on it. And then, you know, Joe and I took to Facebook and Twitter. We're pumping this thing out like crazy, and it just worked out wonderfully. So it, you know, it also unfortunately belly flopped the website, like Chris said, but he was pretty diligent throughout the whole weekend. I think we do, like Chris said, have a great site, and we have and we definitely learned some lessons there. We learned that you know, the one thing that I took away from the whole experience was anything that you put out there, like if you tag a piece of your podcast, right, make sure to put a little intro in front of it. You know, I wish we would have put this clip brought to you by WeAreLibertarians.com and then put the soundbite. Because when all these other news sites swipe your clip, they strip as much out of it as they possibly can, but they seem to not edit the audio.
And
that would have lingered.
Yeah, and what I tried to do is try to be as media-friendly as possible. If you go back and you look at that article on We Are Libertarians, I transcribed the quote, I cut down the audio to the relevant parts, and put in there, you know, if you use this clip, accredit it to us. And that just makes it easier for the reporter. So all they have to do is copy and paste the quote, and they have the clip right there for download. So they don't have to hunt through the podcast. So, you know, the moral of the story is, and by the way, The Blaze didn't even give us credit. They just swiped it, and they gave Mediaite the credit. You know, Huffington Post and Mediaite gave us proper credit. The Blaze didn't, which kind of surprised us, being probably philosophically closer to The Blaze than anybody else. But you have to be smart about this stuff, and you can't have an arrogance about your own stuff. You know, we have a lot of people listening to all of our podcasts, going to our website, but we're not on most people's radar. You know, we have a relatively small corner of the world, and if you want to extend beyond that, you've got to think smart about it. And you know, we just didn't get picked up by Huffington Post and Mediaite because we're so good at doing podcasts. There was some work and some creativity and some public relations work that you got to do behind the scenes. Otherwise, they're not going to see it. You know, people who write for these publications that can drive traffic are probably not listening to your stuff or reading your site. So you've got to put yourself in front of them, and Twitter is a great way to do that.
Yeah, and I think that you and Ryan deserve a lot of credit. I mean, the work that you did, I think it just goes to show the media mind that we have working within the We Are Libertarians organization. And so you guys can give me, you know, credit on the talent front. And I know it sounds like I'm celebrating here, but you guys really got us in front of the right people, and it made such an impact over the course of that weekend that it's definitely cause for celebration in terms of our growth here at We Are Libertarians and the Show Report.
The other takeaway that, you know, if you're a podcaster, if you're thinking about being one and you're listening to this, first of all, you know, great. It's a wonderful, wonderful way to, it's a great, great outlet for your thoughts. Secondly, this interview actually was the first domino to fall that actually led to many of the other guests that Joe mentioned. And so really, if you put in the time, you grind, and you really put in the work and try to, you know, get that first great guest and make the most of it, it seems that that's the one that opens a lot of doors for other people. And so, you know, we followed up the Ron Paul interview with Professor Jeffrey Tucker. That was an amazing show. I've listened to it a number of times, and, you know, that sounds arrogant, but it's not meant to be. It's humbling that that we were able to have such a great guest, and that he just provided so much wonderful content that, you know, that show wasn't great because of the three of us. That show was great because Professor Tucker dropped some wonderful pearls of wisdom that should be, I think, required listening for all libertarians. But that opportunity doesn't happen if Joe doesn't put in the work to get Dr. Paul, and if we don't do the right things to first treat Dr. Paul and his people well, and then to make the most of the opportunity. So,
yeah,
the message there is work hard, get the guests, keep grinding, and good things happen.
What happens is people look at your feed as they vet you, and they say, okay, they've had this person, this person, this person, not just one, but multiple guests and big name guests, or even, you know, Jeffrey Tucker's a big name in the libertarian world, but maybe outside of the libertarian world, they wouldn't see that. But somebody like a just throwing out names, Tom Woods or Lou Rockwell or somebody, they're going to see Ron Paul and Jeffrey Tucker and go, okay, maybe they're legit and maybe I'll talk to them then.
You know, perhaps a big name, guys, that we should go after next is John Cusack. And I know that sounds odd, but, you know, he's in the middle of Hollyweird and they typically don't lean the ways that we do, but he put an op-ed out there in The Guardian concerned over whether or not NSA reporters are protected by the First Amendment. And if you read through it, the link is in the show notes. It really is a pretty hard-hitting piece against Eric Holder and his policies against whistleblowers and journalists, and how they have really, they've gone after these people. And what he really points out, which I really, really enjoyed, was that Glenn Greenwald is in Brazil, Laura Poitras, his associate, is in Germany. And these are two American reporters that are forced to report from, you know, foreign countries for fear of retribution by the government. And he makes that point very clear, and he seriously questions if Laura Poitras or Glenn Greenwald were to come back into the United States, would they be detained, would they be arrested, and what would the consequences be? So for me, guys, it amazes me, and maybe it shouldn't, but it amazes me when someone in the middle of Hollyweird puts an op-ed out that's against a liberal administration. And not only did he take that stand, which I'm sure he's taking a lot of flack for, he framed the argument incredibly well. It's a really good op-ed. I hope you guys get out there and read it. You know, how did it hit you guys?
Well, it's an extensive piece. I mean, it's pretty long, and it's packed with information. And I love John's take on it, but I would love to get Glenn Greenwald or Laura Poitras to give their perspective here on the Show Report. That could be a potential guest for the future. So if you're listening to this podcast and you would love to hear their take on, you know, why they report from where they report and what they think would occur if they were to come back to the United States, I would just encourage listeners to get on their Twitter feeds and hit them up and request that they take part in We Are Libertarians or the Show Report podcast.
My first reaction is, why do I care what John Cusack has to say? I give him credit for being one of the few Hollywood people who are actually coming out and not backing the administration anymore after being fans. I pose the question back to you guys, well-written or not, do when a celebrity writes something like that, do you think people are going to read it because he's a celebrity, or do you think people have the reaction that I have, which is, why do I care what John Cusack has to say? Shut up and make movies.
You know, I don't mind that it's a celebrity making those kind of comments. I like it when people of high profile promote the beliefs and principles that we share. And so he has spread the message of liberty and the message of, you know, what's going on with the NSA scandal to a group of people that may not have initially been interested in the topic. So when he comes out and says, are we going to accept the creation of a generation of exiled watchdogs, you know, who are trying to hold their government accountable from afar, that's not a thought that the hardcore liberal that would read something from John Cusack has in their mind initially. You know, they're looking at things more from the rose-colored, you know, Barack Obama's a great president kind of viewpoint that we do not share. And so for someone who's outside of the libertarian world and who's a little more mainstream and someone who has the ear of liberals to put that kind of information out, that can only do good things for our movement.
Captain TMZ?
I don't know that John Cusack, and granted, I don't know what the litmus test is as far as grading Hollywood celebrity status, but John Cusack is not a Brad Pitt. He's not one of those names that everyone just recognizes for what he does necessarily. So I would say that a lot of people probably see John Cusack op-ed. This guy's talking about the NSA, and that's a relatively normal name. So I think that there's probably people that read that and didn't even think about the fact that he was an actor. It was just this guy talking about, you know, all these things that are going on.
You know, side note for the listeners, if an actor has not twerked with Miley Cyrus, Joe claims they're unknown. So I just want to throw that out.
Joe is our TMZ correspondent around here.
If you haven't twerked, no one cares about your work.
Oh, God. Boo. I don't care where it comes from. Anybody who's high profile that comes out and says these things is positive. I mean, because it needs to be said, it needs to be put out there. I don't know that your average person who just ordinarily wouldn't care about the NSA is going to care more because John Cusack said it. You know, it's more a message to Hollywood liberals, probably more to his own camp than anything else, saying, all right, let's be intellectually honest about this. Here's what we ought to think about this. And I'm going to be the first one to say it, because Hollywood is a huge donor base for the left and for the president, and it really can drive opinion on the left one way or another. And so I do think that it is important that he says it because he does come from a liberal power base and can help sway opinion one way or the other. It wouldn't, after reading it, I don't think it would have swayed my opinion had I had the opposite point of view. But he asks a question that we ought to be asking more and more, especially in light of last week when Congress starts defining what a journalist is. You know, I was thinking about that on the drive home yesterday. So you're telling me that, you know, I help out with a publication and write for a publication occasionally called Howie Politics Indiana. Brian Howie is a real journalist. He's not like us. He's like a real journalist. And like, he has worked at newspapers and he spent 30 years doing it. And in 1994, he struck out on his own and created his own internet publication called Howie Politics Indiana. And became self-employed. I don't know that he'd be covered under this statute because he's self-employed. So if you're like us and we eventually want to hire reporters and go out and sort of become a Reason or a National Review type, not a publication because our version of a magazine is the podcast, but would we be covered because we are small business owners, that we are self-started? You know, I think he's raising questions that people need to think about in this environment when you've got an administration that is so willing to erode freedom of the press.
Well, if you look at how polarized the media is now, too, I know a lot of people like to say it's partisan games in Congress, but it's also partisan games in the media. And so for someone like John Cusack to get the message out there and to try to break the barriers, because let's face it, there a lot of us have a strict Fox News diet or a strict MSNBC diet or a strict CNN diet. And it's kind of like the bacon diet, right? It tastes good for a while, but it can't be positive for your health long term. And it's just how the Fox diet or the CNN or the MSNBC diet, yeah, you enjoy what they say, but long term, you're really rotting your brain out. And if this kind of work or these kind of pieces from celebrities like John Cusack, if this plants a different kind of seed in someone's brain, you know, if this is a, if someone that traditionally only listens to MSNBC and has drunk that Kool-Aid, if they get some of these ideas in their head and at least they start bouncing around a bit, I think that's only good things. Speaking of influencing the media, though, this is a last-minute addition. Breitbart has reported about Senator Ted Cruz, and Senator Ted Cruz came out and said, "I don't think anyone should be surprised that the mainstream media echoes the talking points of the Obama White House. The media have been President Obama's most enthusiastic cheerleaders since the day he launched his campaign. That will surely continue through the course of this battle. But at the end of the day, the media are not going to decide this." Now, this, in this context, is the Obamacare debate. And it's an interesting kind of spin that's been going on throughout the media and also throughout households across America. Right now, the narrative is that the Republicans are obstructing the president and that could lead to a shutdown of government. But Chris, I think you've brought up, you know, a really interesting point in our some of our previous conversations that I'd love for you to share with the listeners.
You look at the media and the bias is clearly towards the pro-government side, okay? When you look at the coverage of the proposed government shutdown, it is all written as if the Republicans are the only ones who are playing a part in the government shutdown, that they are the kamikazes that, you know, and they've got their sycophant teat feeders, let me phrase that in a family-friendly way, John McCain and Lindsey Graham helping push this narrative. They're saying, oh, well, it's a kamikaze, they're wrong. Peter King comes out, oh, they're all traitors to the Constitution, which there couldn't be a bigger traitor to the Constitution than the worst representative ever, Peter King. Just like to add that. Why is it always, and Ted Cruz has made this point, why is it always the small government side that has to give in? Why is it that we are the ones that always have to say, oh, you're right? Why is the media always on the side of, why is it the Republicans' fault? You know, you've got a president that flat out makes speech after speech about how he refuses to negotiate on the debt ceiling. He refuses to negotiate on Obamacare. He just puts up a firewall between himself and Congress and the Republicans especially. Why doesn't he take any of the blame for it? Why does the media continually report the side of pro-government? And I think the media at large has to ask itself that very question. You know, why are your headlines written in a way that it is always the Republicans' fault? It is always the small government person that is to blame. When you've got a president and a Democratic side that is flat out arrogantly saying, I'm sorry, we're not going to do a thing about the debt. This is how it is. You can take it and like it. And of course, Obama's going to do that because that's his MO. Blame it all on the Republicans. Don't talk to Congress and blame it all on the Republicans. Like, that is how he does everything. That's why he didn't get Summers through. That's how he was going to lose the Syria vote, because he doesn't get involved and engaged with Congress, and then he blames the Republicans. So I can't stand it. You know, it just drives me crazy.
Now, let me be clear. I want a balanced budget for this country. It's a good thing for the people. But what I will not accept is a budget that defunds Obamacare from my Republican friends.
You sound more
we've
like...
We've got to come together, but I refuse to negotiate.
You sound more
any
like
of these items.
Butthead.
And if they don't bend, they're obstructing.
You sound more like Butthead than Obama.
It's kind of
yeah, we've not had a president in a long time. You know, when Bush would go out and give speeches, he'd say, you know, some might say that there's this strain of thinking that blah, blah, blah. Obama's really one of the first presidents, if the only one, that comes out and says, John Boehner and the Republicans are who you should blame. You know, that sort of direct blame is not very, it's not normal for presidents to do. You know, I'm sure if I were a Democrat, I would think it's good. If I were a Republican, I'd think it's bad. But it is a unique, different thing that Obama does. He comes out and names who people should blame.
I think a lot of it has to do with marketing. The left has been able to successfully market and I think I heard Rush Limbaugh talk about this one day, that the liberal points of view are now being marketed as the objective thoughts. And anything aside from what the left would argue is considered to be extreme. It's considered to be fringe. So if they can stake claim to these are our viewpoints, these are based on fact, these are based on science, anything else, and everything else is fringe and everything else is extreme, then, I mean, that's the way that the political landscape is going to go. The libertarians, conservatives, Republicans, whatever, they have to be able to take control of the perception of objectivity, because that's something that the left has gotten away with, and that's something that they'll continue to away with until we can find a way to successfully market ourselves as being more reasonable, but not only reasonable, but being fact. And I think that it's amazing because the left, obviously their policies have been detrimental to the American economy, to American foreign policy now, and for them to claim that that's just the way that it should be, that is fact, and that everything else is extreme, it's kind of a stretch, and yet it's accepted widely.
We talked about, Ryan and I were talking about this before the show. At this point, when you look at the results of the big government experiment the last 100 years, it's completely failed. When you look at Robert Reich has a new documentary out, and he was on The Daily Show this past week, and I'd invite you to go look at The Daily Show clip of Robert Reich. And the beginning of it, he talks about the working poor who made $30,000 a year in 1970 versus the working poor who made $30,000 a year last year. Really, they take home something like $30,000 in 1970, and now you take home something like $14,000 because of the inflationary cost of housing, of food, of gas, of insurance. And we're not better off now than we were 100 years ago. I'm sorry. Well, most of us. I mean, there obviously society has become more equal, but when it comes to economics, it's certainly not more equal for the most part, all things being equal. Mm-hmm. The experiment has failed. In my opinion, we ought to start treating people like John McCain and Lindsey McGraham, the interventionists, and we should start treating big government liberals like Barack Obama as if they're flat earthers. Treat them the way that Al Gore treats people who deny global warming. Mock them, make fun of them, and call them stupid and irrelevant, because that's what that they ought to be.
So the thought I have on that is, should we call out their tactics as well? You know, when they come out and they say, you know, if I ask you, Chris, how long have you been beating your wife? How do you answer that? And I'd also say when they come out and say, well, when Republicans vote to defund Obamacare, they hate the poor. They want women and children and the elderly to die in the streets. I see it as the same kind of commentary or question. You know, how do you answer that? Because clearly no one wants these people dying in the streets. No one wants people to go without health care. But the conservative or the libertarian view is to do it to reform health care in different ways. And that part gets dropped. It gets dropped in the media. It gets dropped in conversations. It gets dropped by the talking heads. It's a tactic that these people use in order to bring emotionally charged imagery to the discussion. And I think that kind of stuff has to be called out too.
Yeah.
All right. Moving on.
Good point, Ryan.
Hey, thanks. speaking of influencing the media, guys, the New York Times has taken quite a hit for running a recent op-ed from Vladimir Putin about the events in Syria and the back and forth between him and the Obama administration. You know, some have said that they've attacked the credibility of the op-ed. They've attacked the credibility of the New York Times. You know, whether or not Vladimir Putin wrote it himself or not, you know, Chris, I think you've said before that, you know, no president writes his own comments on his own. So not sure about those attacks. However, the Times did post a blog article or a blog post about the thinking behind publishing the Putin op-ed and also how it even came about. And so really, it's an interesting peek behind the curtains of how an op-ed story comes to life, how a newspaper decides whether or not to publish it. And really what this essentially came down to was, you know, the Vladimir Putin's people presented this op-ed through multiple channels. It got into the hands of the editors. They thought it was well-written, well-argued. They didn't necessarily agree with all the points, but it was relevant because of the ongoing story in Syria, and so they ran it. To me, guys, it makes perfect sense that if a president of a country who's in the middle of a serious global issue with your country wants to write an op-ed, that seems newsworthy to me. What's your guys' take? Unpatriotic of the New York Times, or did they do the right thing?
Heck no. Patriotism should never factor into some newspaper's decision. You know, Rupert Murdoch, the reason he takes so much crud, I remember when he started The Daily on the iPad, and they asked him what the bent of the newspaper was going to be. He said, it will be patriotic. It's like, well, I don't really care if a newspaper is patriotic or not. I just want the facts, you know? And the New York Times did the right thing by publishing the information. And this is the problem that we have in our society today, is that everybody's trying to protect everybody else from some other differing point of view. And everyone wants to try and live in their own little communal bubble, when the fact is you should have all the information laid out before you and then make the best decision. And, you know, libertarians scream this all the time, especially when it comes to debates. Let all three choices on the ballot in, or let even more than that in. Let people hear all of the ideas, and then let them choose the one that they think is the best. You don't have to protect me from certain points of view. You know, we don't have to protect you from Noam Chomsky. You can agree or disagree with him at all. You know, we're not infecting you with bad ideas. We're trying to expand critical thinking, and I think that's the point of view of the New York Times, and it should be of every newspaper. Give us all the facts and let us decide.
It's like Jeffrey Tucker said last week when he reads the New York Times. You have to almost have kind of a decoder ring, and it's like that with any news source, especially those in the mainstream. And I think that you could say, for people who want patriotic news, that there's really nothing more patriotic than the fact that ideally, if any country is going to print the perspective of another country's president, that it's the United States of America that's doing it. I think it's fantastic, and we should be allowed to do that. But for those who thought it was a bad idea, and for those who threw accusations at the New York Times, and they didn't want that to be something that was put out there, you know, I thought to myself, well, you know, because they were saying that this shouldn't even be something that's happened, you know, and I thought to myself, well, what actually does it take to get an op-ed printed in the New York Times? And so I went to their website and I dug around, you know, and all it says is that the New York Times accepts opinions on any topic, and that the suggested length is 750 words, but submissions of any length will be considered, and that and here's a quote: "We ask that all submissions be sent exclusively to the Times. We will not consider the articles or articles that have been already printed or published online," end quote. And then they go on to say that there is no ideological litmus test for an op-ed article. He said that the purpose of op-ed pages to help or hurt the American it is not the purpose of op-ed pages to help or hurt the American government. It is to present a variety of interesting and newsworthy points of view, at least some of which will be contrary to the Times' own point of view expressed in its editorials. And so I don't think that the New York Times did anything incorrect in having Vladimir Putin's op-ed printed. I think it's fantastic that they did that. What I take away from the New York Times op-ed submission guidelines is the idea that a news organization or outlet should have its own points of views. Because I think that, you know, it's like you said, Chris, we want the facts. We just want the facts. We don't care, you know, what the spin is. We just want the facts. And so they almost seem to imply there that there's a set of viewpoints that are particular to that news source. And so, you know, is that right? Should a news organization be bound to one point of view?
I watch a lot of book TV on C-SPAN on the weekends because I'm a complete nerd like that. And a week or two ago, they had Ben Shapiro on. And Ben Shapiro is a columnist, talk radio show host in L.A., and also edits Breitbart. And, you know, he said, my philosophy is that I have a definite point of view, I have a definite worldview, but when I go to argue my worldview, I want to argue it from the perspective of knowing the other side. Okay, so I want to hear all of the arguments from the other side, and then I want to deconstruct those arguments. At the same time, I'm I'm pointing out the flaws in their logic and argument, I'm also giving my point of view through that process, and it also helps me understand what is the best way to argue my point of view. Because if I can argue my point of view anti-theirs, then people mm-hmm. will see that I have the superior logic. And I think that's just right on. I mean, if you don't understand the other side's point of view, and this is my problem with a lot of conservative media, is that they're just shouting out what they think. They're not taking into consideration what the hearer is listening to, what the hearer is hearing, and what the other side is saying about them. Because the conservative media especially has put themselves into a bubble and does not allow dissenting opinions in. Whereas the left, in many ways, they focus on deconstructing the conservative arguments. And mm-hmm. that is probably why they see the liberal bias, is because the liberals and the media are deconstructing the conservative argument. And there ought to be more Ben Shapiros out there, even though I think he's just so totally wrong on so much stuff. That point of view is what the small government
guys,
side needs.
But I mean, and that's great, but that's just one guy. But in terms of a news organization, a mainstream media news organization like The Times, having its own set of viewpoints, let me ask you this way. Okay, their mission statement says, and this is directly from their website, the core purpose of the New York Times Company is to enhance society by creating, collecting, and distributing high-quality news, information, and entertainment. The central place of our news and editorial units is fulfilling that promise and is underscored by the number one statement in our core values, content of the highest quality and integrity. This is the basis of our reputation and the means by which we fulfill the public trust and our customers' expectations. It then goes on to say, company-wide, our goal is to cover the news impartially and to treat readers, news sources, advertisers, and all parts of our society fairly and openly, and to be seen as doing so. But many perceive the New York Times as having this liberal point of view, and you know, as mentioned in their mission statement, they aim to cover the news impartially to all parts of society fairly and openly. So are they doing something wrong, and are they acting against their own mission?
No, I mean, we've had the argument about the Washington Post, and I heard an interview with it was on either – there's three podcasts that are other good journalism podcasts that I listen to, Matt Lewis and the News, It's All Journalism, and the Long Form Podcast. It was in one of those recently with a Washington Post person. It was an interview with Bart Gellman on Fresh Air. That's what it was. And he was saying, you know, I love the fact that our editorial board came out and bashed my reporting, because it shows that there is a wall between the news side and the editorial side, and mm-hmm. that we can take our reporting and look at it critically and criticize it. We called it schizophrenic, but Bart Gellman said he loves that. And I think that you look at David Brooks. David Brooks is their token conservative, and I wouldn't compare him with Newt Gingrich or Rush Limbaugh in any way, shape, or form. You know, he's certainly pro-power. I don't contribute the New York Times or any other newspaper's bias towards liberal. Their bias is towards power. Their bias is towards the power structure. And libertarians and conservatives and small government people, they bristle at that, because our bias is anti-power for the most part. I'm mm-hmm. Not including Lindsey Graham and John McCain in the small government crowd. You know, it's now authoritarian versus libertarian. And mm-hmm. the major newspapers are more pro-authoritarian than anything else.
You know what, guys? I think it really comes back to what we were saying earlier about the strict Fox News diet or the MSNBC diet. You know, the clashing of ideas, it's a core principle of America. You know, the freedom of the press is there so that we can disagree with the government, so that we can see opposing views. I think the New York Times upheld that tradition very well. You know, and it also reminds me of Proverbs 27:17. An iron sharpens iron, so one person sharpens another. And if we don't have those interactions, if we don't have those intersecting points of philosophical views and policy, we don't sharpen one another, we don't learn the opposing views, and we don't know how to respond to people who think differently than we do. And so the New York Times running this op-ed is a great service, I think, to the American people. They get to see a global view of America, not just the rah-rah-rah, America is exceptional, that most talking heads feel compelled to say. They get this outside viewpoint that, wow, maybe America's not viewed as this shining light on a hill that we all think it is. To me, it's a great service, and I hope that we continue to sharpen one another by having these kinds of discussions and by being exposed to opposing ideas.
I just want to clarify that I guess my little rant didn't have so much to do with the op-ed, which I think was a great addition to their publication, but it was just that when I began to look into what it actually took to get an op-ed in their paper, and when I read through that mission statement, I began to think, well, if they do have a bias towards power, does that really make them as open and fair as they claim to be? And so it was almost a separate thought, but I think It needed some clarification.
Yeah, I think I am a libertarian because my views were challenged by Andy Horning and Abdul Hakim Shabazz. Because those two challenged my little Rush Limbaugh rants and I had to find facts to defend them, I eventually just didn't have the facts to back up what I was saying, and that's how I eventually became a libertarian. So you learn best by having to defend your beliefs.
Well, I'm a libertarian because Ryan Ledke asked me, how is it right to force other people to pay for Obamacare? You know, how is it right to take money from one person, give it to another, and when they haven't earned it? And I could not answer that question. And that question is shattering to someone who is previously a Democrat, because most of the policy involves taking money from one group and giving it to another. And when Ryan pointed out that, hey, that's theft, and that initially that idea didn't take hold, but I couldn't shake it. I couldn't shake that thought that it's theft. And it turns out that that's right. It is theft. When you overtax one group for the benefit of another, you are forcefully taking money from someone and giving it to another person. That is theft. And that clash of ideas led me to where we are right now. And I think Chris is absolutely right. Defending your ideas sharpens your ideas and in some ways shatters them and makes you rebuild them. And there's nothing better than that. A closed mind is a dangerous one, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. One of the best explanations, and it's so simple, for someone who, when I first got into libertarian philosophy and the thoughts, Mary Ruart has a book. It's pretty old now. I think it was written in like the 80s or something, Healing Our World in an Age of Aggression, and it's been revised. But, I mean, she broke down the concept that government uses force, you know, taxation is force, and she puts it in a really simple way, and there's even some, like, funny drawings and stuff that kind of map it out for you. But for someone who wants to understand that, I would recommend the first few chapters of that book because it just put it out there in a way that's very elementary, and it makes you go, oh, yeah, why didn't I see that before?
You can find that book at theadvocates.org in the store section. All right, so...
You know, Chris, someone who ended up looking pretty dull in this whole situation was John McCain. Care to shed a little light on that and let the listeners know exactly how John McCain got this situation totally wrong?
Sad, old, confused John McCain. Megan ought to point her daddy in the right direction of a clue. Although I'm sure she's not a very good guide of it either. He wrote an article for Pravda. Now, Pravda is the communist newspaper founded 100 years ago that has been the mouthpiece of the Communist Party in the USSR, I mean Russia. And, you know, so he made the offhanded comment that, you know, I ought to write an op-ed for Pravda. So... The Cable, the blog for foreign policy, reached out to Pravda and said, would John McCain write an article for you? And Pravda said, sure. But the problem was Pravda.ru is an English news site in Russia and is not the same as the communist newspaper. So John McCain started writing for the wrong Pravda. and had it published on in the wrong Pravda. He did submit it to both, but the Communist Party said they wouldn't print it unless it fell in line with the ideals of the Communist Party of Russia. So, boy, there's two stark differences between the New York Times and Pravda, isn't there?
Oh, absolutely. But poor John McCain.
You
know,
feel bad
I guess
for
him. The bright takeaway from that whole exchange is that, you know, it did prove that the American press is a lot freer than many of the other presses around the world. And, you know, while we do rail and against the media from time to time on this podcast, we are in a far better situation than many of the other countries in the world. However,
get better, John McCain.
What's that?
Get better, John McCain. It's okay.
John McCain, get your act together. You're on notice, son.
How much would it take for him to redeem himself at this point?
Retirement.
There you go. That's it.
If the rumors that he's retiring are true and he takes Lindsey Graham with them and they go sit in a fishing boat for the rest of their lives, that's redemption. You know, speaking of another person that could use a lot of redemption, let's talk about our good friend Jay Carney in another segment of our favorite game, Jay Carney Says What. You guys ready for it?
Yeah, let's do it.
You want to play? Let's end the day on a high note with Jay Carney. Chris, I want you on the board on this one.
Not going to happen.
You got to get on the board. Here's the premise. Here's the question. Immediately following Vladimir Putin's op-ed in the New York Times, Jay Carney was put on the spot asking his thoughts and opinions and the position of the White House on that op-ed. He had an interesting answer. You guys need to pick it out of which three I'm going to give you. Here we go. Answer one, we're not surprised by Vladimir Putin's words, but the fact is Russia offers a stark contrast that demonstrates why America is exceptional. Unlike Russia, the United States stands up for democratic values and human rights in our country and around the world. And we believe our global security can be advanced when children cannot be gassed to death by a dictator. That's answer number one. Answer number two. The New York Times and the White House press room are not the appropriate places to conduct diplomacy. Matters of foreign correspondence are handled by the State Department, and I would refer you to them for any questions about Mr. Putin's op-ed. Answer number three, there will be no comment about Mr. Putin's op-ed today. Our focus needs to be on the innocent Syrians who are suffering at the hands of Assad. Next question. In response to Vladimir Putin's op-ed, did Jay Carney go on the offensive and call out Assad as the butchering dictator that many believe him to be? Or did he state that the New York Times and the White House press room are not the appropriate venues for such discussions? Or number three, did he throw a temper tantrum and demand the next question?
Chris, go ahead.
So you can what? Just choose the one that I don't choose so you'll be right?
gut instinct.
I'm going to go number one. I feel the other two are ridiculous. So I guess I should probably go with two or three, but I'm just going to go with number one.
I was going to go with number one too, but now that Chris has said it. No, it sounds the most reasonable.
But the problem with this game.
I know. That's the problem with this game is he always does unreasonable. I'm going to go with three. I'm going to call an audible here.
What's the most ridiculous?
I know it's ridiculous. But that could very well be Jay Carney.
All right, so Joe Ruiz, you're locking in on next question. Not going to talk about it. Chris, you're locking in on Assad kills children.
Yep.
All righty, let's listen to the clip and see how it falls.
As for the editorial, you know, we're not surprised by President Putin's words. But the fact is that Russia offers a stark contrast that demonstrates why America is exceptional. Unlike Russia, the United States stands up for democratic values and human rights in our own country and around the world. And we believe that our global security is advanced when children cannot be gassed to death by a dictator.
Spangle is on the board.
Oh,
Spangle.
My God.
You are the winner this week, sir.
I'd like to thank all the little people who got me here.
Would that be Joe and I?
Yes.
Guys, great work this week. Chris, congratulations on getting a point up on Joe Ruiz. I think he's still ahead of you 3-2, but you are catching up.
Oh, I think I'm like, have I won before?
No, yeah. I think it's like 3-1.
Maybe it's 3-1. We'll check the record and make sure it's straight for the next.
You're more sad and can...
It's like, whose line is it anyway? The points don't really matter.
You're more.
Yeah, it's not. You're gonna turn them in for bozo prizes at the end of the year, anyway.
You're more sad and confused than John McCain.
Well, all right, guys, that wraps it up for this week. If you'd like to reach out to us, go to the We Are Libertarians Facebook page or Twitter account and use the Show Report hashtag to leave us a note. Find out what we left out of this episode on page 2 of the Show Report, available at WeAreLibertarians.com. Listen in on iTunes or wall-radio.com to hear past episodes, including conversations with Dr. Ron Paul and Professor Jeffrey Tucker. The show report also plays on indianatalks.com. And remember, folks, when the media breaks the news, the show report is here to fix it.